us on the summit today is technology addiction expert, Dr. David Greenfield. David, welcome and thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Nice to be here.
Now, you are obviously a technology addiction expert. You've been doing this for decades, and your work is just taking off now. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I've been at it since the mid to late 1990s. So this has been not a new thing for me in terms of looking at how the internet is addictive. But, you know, my background's in addiction medicine. So, I was an addiction medicine doctor for many, many years. And then in the late 90s, I started to do some research and work with internet addiction. And then this is back when we only had dial up and we didn't have smartphones or Wi-Fi or laptops or tablets. So it was a whole different time. But even then we saw that the technology was potentially addictive and really people had a hard time turning it off. And obviously that's changed drastically because of the ease of access and the speed of the internet and the overall availability of it.
Mm-hmm. And you were just telling me before the call, you just got in on a red eye last night. You're on many, many media shows. This issue is blowing up, and you're obviously a pioneer in that. What are some of the avenues that are you're reaching?
Well, that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's also reminding me of how much older I am than everybody else, because I've been, as I said, doing this since the mid to late 90s. What's happened is it's reached a bit of a tipping point. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with the incredible increase in speed and access to technology and the untethered portability that we have with smartphones particularly, which are really the dominant or have become the dominant internet access portal, it's really just moved it into a new level where the average person is having a hard time managing their tech use, let alone people who might be diagnosable from a psychiatric perspective, as having a real addiction. That's a relatively small number compared to the majority of us who are overusing our technology simply in the course of our daily lives. So there's sort of two groups. There are people that are really having clinical problems to a point where their lives are unmanageable. And then there's the rest of us who are probably overusing it to a point that although our lives are not unmanageable, they could probably be a lot healthier and happier with less time on these devices.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. Thanks for that overview. I'm just going to share with our audience a little bit more about your background, and then we'll dive in further. You're the founder and medical director of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction and assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. You've authored Virtual Addiction, which was a work in 1999 that rang the bell about this whole, the warning bell about this whole issue. And you lecture throughout the world. Recent work focused on the neurobiology and psychopharmacology of compulsive internet, smartphone, and technology use, and distracted driving. You know, it's interesting. I have seen over the past few years, people just have a common knowledge about how pervasive smartphone and technology addiction is. I mean, some of these videos, I remember seeing like 3 or 4 years ago, this video on YouTube called Look Up, and it was showing about how we're missing life. You know,
thing about technology, all screen technology that's internet interfaced, is that it eats time. You know, you can't do it without your eyes being glued to it. So anything that requires your eyes and your attention and your focus to be elsewhere, meaning real-time living, life, then requires you to not be looking at the screen. So to the extent that you want to have a balanced life and, you know, look outside and see a beautiful tree that's blooming, you can't be looking at your screen. So it's really either or. You can't bilocate. This idea that you can be in two worlds, you can participate in the world or in real-time relationships or have intimacy or experience nature or participate in the in your work or your academics or your love in your life, you can't do that while you're on your phone or on your laptop or tablet. It's not possible. So you have to make a choice. And the technology gives the illusion that you don't have to make a choice, that you can have it all. You can be on these devices and still experience life to the fullest. That's just not true.
Yeah, well said. I was just going to ask that. It seems like there's a choice point that eventually we as a society, and more importantly, we as individuals have to make.
Yeah, and that choice really comes down to every time you pick up your phone or every time you go on a tablet. You know, at that moment, you have to say, do I need this right now? Or is this something that is this where I want to be? Is this where I want to spend my time? And not to get too maudlin, but the idea is, you know, if you have a limited amount of time on this planet, which we all do, we all have 24 hours in a day. Nobody gets more. And we all have a limited amount of time in our lifespan, although we don't know how much. The truth is, how much of it do you want to have spent on devices? Right now, we're spending 4 to 6 years, depending on who we are, on our devices, if you add it up. So the question is, at the end of your life, do you want to have spent 5, 10, 15, 20 years of your waking lives on a device? And what do you get for it? At what point do you determine whether it's what I call nutritive? Is it providing you any nutritive value beyond the distraction, beyond the minimization of boredom, which we are deathly afraid of? We are incredibly uncomfortable with being bored for a few minutes or having a moment of nothingness, which, by the way, from which comes everything.
Good point, yeah. So focusing in on 5G and the Internet of Things, you mentioned several years of our lives are going into screens at this current level of technology. But with 5G and the Internet of Things, what are your concerns as a technology addiction?
So what I will tell you from an addiction medicine perspective is that the faster a substance or a behavior get incorporated into the nervous system, whether it's internet or a drug or gambling or food for that matter as well, the faster that substance enters the nervous system or that behavior is engaged in, and then you have a subsequent experience of pleasure or elevation of dopamine, which is normal, and the internet elevates dopamine just like many other substances and behaviors. The shorter the lag between the click of that button or the swipe of your hand on that pad and then the appearance of the content that you're searching for, the more addictive that substance or behavior, and in this case, the internet, will be. So if your phone is almost instantaneous, it's going to become that much more addictive. So my prediction would be, based on what I've seen over the last 20 years, is that as we increase speeds of internet access to 5G, especially on portableized devices, we're going to see even more issues with people being unable to put them down and feeling like they're addicted or tethered to their devices.
So do you see it going in a potentially a dystopian future like The Matrix, or is it not?
I love The Matrix. You know, I love the movie anyway. Yeah. I mean, the thing about dystopian writing is that it's all based on a potential kernel of possibility. I mean, obviously, we hope that it won't occur in the way The Matrix turned out. But I certainly think if we look at our lifestyle and our behaviors and how we use our machines and our devices now, It sure looks a lot more like science fiction did now than it did 25, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So we are looking a lot more screen-based and a lot more distracted and a lot more controlled by our devices than we've ever have. Now, will it get to a point where we're tethered into our devices and, you know, we no longer talk to each other? I mean, I don't know. I think dystopian concepts are basically designed to be wake-up calls for us, mm-hmm. and to determine whether we're going in the direction that we ultimately want to go, and hey, we might want to think this thing through a little bit. I mean, really, that's what we're saying. Can we think this thing through, and is this really a choice point that we want to make? And it's not so much about predicting the future, because nobody can predict the future.
Yeah. Okay, so for the common viewer who doesn't sort of struggle with a, you know, clinically diagnosable technology addiction, most of us, how significant is this issue still for us? Because, I mean, I
would dare say, although the research on this is unclear, because nobody's really studied normal people. We tend to study people who are having a problem. So I would dare say that 80% of average users will admit that at times they overuse their devices, and they would self-describe as an addiction. Now, that doesn't mean they meet the criteria medically for an addiction, but they would say, you know, I'm really addicted to this. I mean, you hear that every day. And I, you know, I was talking to somebody from one of our medical facilities out in California this week. And, you know, she was asking me about my work, and what she was asking about wasn't so much what I was doing medically. She was concerned about herself. She was concerned how much she's using it and whether she should be looking at using it less. So I think most of us, certainly in the 80% range, give or take, are probably overusing our devices. And if you look at our screen use, you know, most phones will now record our screen use, depending on the age of the phone. You know, it's not unusual to have between 2 and 6 hours a day on these little screens. So I guess the question is, you know, where do you want to spend that 2 to 6 hours?
Right. Can you talk about, I mean, because I notice I have a smartphone. Most of the time it's either in airplane mode or wired when I'm in my home office. But I notice that when I go to my phone in the morning to check messages or to use it or to even just go on email on my computer, when I do that before I consciously start my day doesn't turn out typically as well. Can you talk about that? Is this technology making us more kind of docile and passive, and are we being, you know, less awake and alive simply by not starting our day consciously?
Well, the use of technology and screens is a passive use. You're not really facilitating your experience, and you're not interfacing with your experience. You're a passive consumer of your experience. So I don't know about what you just said about whether I'd have a better day if I didn't look at it. I will tell you that when I look at it in the morning, it sucks me in. And so I'm, you know, it takes me another 10 or 15 minutes to get moving in the morning because I'm looking at the news feed and I'm looking at what's going on in the world. And I don't know that that's a good use of my time. So whether it ultimately affects the quality of my day or not, I don't know. I can't speak to that. But I will tell you it sucks you in. And again, it comes down to choice. Can't, you know, since you have a limited amount of time, I like the idea of giving yourself a dose of when you have it and how much you're going to use it, just so you don't end up wasting an excessive amount of time. And then there are neurological factors, because if you dose yourself with too much pleasure due to the use of the internet, your ability to experience pleasure from real-time activities actually drops.
Mm-hmm. That's a really important point, I think.
Well, and that's a neurological thing. This isn't psychological. This is, if you dose yourself up with dopamine hits all throughout the day from your screen, you develop what's called reward deficiency syndrome, which is this idea that you've actually saturated yourself dopaminergically, and you cannot sort of get those natural experiences of dopamine that would occur under normal circumstances because you've been dosing yourself up externally with dopamine. And you end up downregulating your normal level of dopamine, your normal pleasure levels. And you see this all the time, that people, literally, if they don't have their screen in front of them, they don't know what to do. They don't know how to just sit. I dare say if you're in any situation where you're waiting for something, or you're in, you know, a waiting room or at an airport or in a waiting room or in a restaurant, there's virtually nobody that doesn't have their phone open. So now that's only been around for 10 years. So what did we do before that when we were in those circumstances? I mean, I assume we sat there, right? We didn't, you know, maybe we read a book, but for the most part, people just sat and thought. They thought thoughts. They had creative impulses. They might have even talked to somebody real time. They might have actually conversed with their neighbor. They might have started a conversation. So I was in a cafe in Palm Springs, and there was a fellow having a cup of coffee next to me, and we started a conversation. Now, neither of us had our phones out. I'm sure if one of us had our phone out, neither of us would be talking. Yeah. Because the phone conveys to the world and everybody in it that you're not open for business.
Wow, good point. What's the link, if there is a link, can you talk about between technology speed or internet connection speed and addictive quality?
Well, I kind of alluded to that before. The speed is sort of what allows the internet to get into your bloodstream or really into your nervous system. Mm-hmm. The faster the speed, the closer or the shorter the lag between the click and the input that you get into your brain from whatever content you're looking at. The shorter that speed, or rather the faster that speed, or the shorter that lag, the more addictive that is. This is why crack cocaine is more addictive than injected or snorted cocaine.
Because it's instant?
Because it's instant. Anything that's really quick is going to be more addictive than something that has a little bit of a lag. So when the internet, 20 years ago, when I started doing my work, was on dial-up, and it took 3 minutes for a photo to scan onto your screen, we didn't see record levels of addiction because it took too long, although we did see some. So now that you have a phone and all you have to do is go like this and you see it, and that's at 4G, my theory would be that we're going to see higher levels of addiction and higher levels of overuse and abuse because of the faster speed. Now, I don't think that's going to stop 5G from coming. I think as soon as they get the bugs out of it, it's going to be rolled out like crazy.
Well, what we intend to do, obviously, in the summit is to counterbalance that with a conscious discussion. So, again, thank you for being part of this.
I don't mean to be pessimistic, but I just think there's a lot of money behind technology. So the motivation is to roll it out. Because when it comes to technology, necessity isn't the rule, convenience is.
Yeah, that's what's being sold, obviously, is the convenience factor. Downloading a movie in 6 seconds or...
Yeah. Right. So, so the question is, and that's true, you'll be able to do that. The question is that a good thing?
Yeah.
You know, this is the same debate we've had about many advances in technology. Just because we can do it, does that mean we should do it?
So you mentioned the kind of instantaneous reward / dopamine factors in an ever faster network
paradigm, because your nervous system associates that click with a dopamine surge. So the faster you do it, the more potentially addictive it will become.
Okay. Is there any other points to be aware of in terms of potential negative consequences of going faster and faster in addition to that instant reward type system?
Not the faster and faster, it's just the amount of use, because the faster it is, the more appealing it'll be, which theoretically will increase the number of people that are overusing it and abusing it. It's also highly distractible, which brings us into the issue of doing it while you drive. So it gives the illusion that you could do something fast. So if you're in your car and you pick up your phone, you can say, well, let me just send this social media update really quickly. And now with 5G, I can do it even faster. But the truth is, it only takes a fraction of a second to get into an accident. So unless you can move your fingers at the speed of light and pick up your device and put it down within 0.3 seconds or 0.5 seconds, you're still going to be susceptible to have an accident. So again, it gives the illusion, my concern is it'll give the illusion that you can do it quicker, but the truth is that we already have record levels of people being killed due to distracted driving, and now you're more likely to die in a distracted driving accident or at the hands of somebody else who's driving distracted than you are from alcohol-related issues.
Wow. Do you have any more stats on that? Because I know that's just huge.
If you're using your device, there's a sevenfold increase in the likelihood that you're going to have an accident while driving. There's over 1,600,000 incidents and accidents regarding distracted driving per year.
Wow.
So, you know, we're talking about a lot of, the phone is in the car is basically Russian roulette. And most of us do it, by the way. We did a study a number of years ago with AT&T, and we asked people, you know, quite frankly, we surveyed 1,000 people across the states, looking at all demographics and ages, and 80% of us admit to doing it when we're driving. I mean, it's not just the other people. It's you and I. It's everybody does it. It's not unique to an age group. It's not just limited to people who are under 21. I mean, lots of people will use their devices while they drive.
So a bit of a curveball here, David. What can you tell us, if anything, about the potential physical addiction from the frequencies and the wireless waves themselves?
Well, before I talk about the frequency and the wireless waves, which again, I'm not an expert on, I can tell you that one of the things we do see with smartphones is that it elevates cortisol, which is a stress hormone. So what happens when we elevate cortisol, and by the way, that's if you see the phone, you don't even have to touch it or have it to your ear. If you see your phone, you're going to establish, there'll be an adrenal release of cortisol, which again is a stress hormone. And the negative of that is, of course, you're putting your body into a stress response. But the natural response to a stress response is to pick up the phone and check it. And actually, when you check it, you get a little decrease in that cortisol level. So you end up with this yo-yo experience throughout the day of elevation of cortisol, checking it, and then elevating it again over and over and over again. And that's one of the reasons why we feel compelled to never put it down. Because as soon as we do, our cortisol level raises, and then we have to check it again to reduce it. In terms of the frequencies, I mean, again, I'm not an expert on what the addiction of particular RF frequencies. I mean, I do know about RF energy, and I do understand that, you know, it is a form of electromagnetic radiation. But I don't know enough about whether and how one becomes addicted to a specific frequency of radiation.
Okay. Are smartphones and these technologies, with so much money and focus and design and development and, you know, marketing, sales, driving the intention, are they created to be addictive by design?
Well, you know, I think when the inventor of the smart, you know, the cell phone was developed, I don't think anybody in a million years thought that it would become addictive. I think they were inventing something really cool and really neat, which is many times the case. I think that as the smartphone, the modern version of the smartphone, which is really 10 years old, you know, that Apple really kind of pioneered, I think they knew relatively quickly that it had an addictive potential. But I don't think until about 2010 or 12 did we have an inkling based on the data that it was really becoming seriously addictive. I think that's a fairly new phenomenon, well under 10 years, that we have the data that looks at it, the behavior, the people's behavior with regard to smartphone use. Then do I think they capitalized on that, you know, not just the phone manufacturers, but the service providers and the browser companies and all the people that stood to benefit from having our eyes on screen? Absolutely. I think that they knew that it was addictive. I think that's shifting again now in a positive direction, because I think there's been substantial pressure by consumer groups, by consumers, and now the government. And now there's enough data to say, hey, not so fast. This is a problem. And you just can't keep spreading this technology out and not addressing the implications and the side effects of it. So I think that's changing. There's a greater, I think we're at a new point in society right now where there's going to be greater accountability with these tech companies, and that's really happening.
Yeah. I want to briefly talk about some specific websites or applications. Let's use Facebook as an example. There's been a lot of, obviously, controversy, but...
Facebook is designed to be addictive. It was pretty much from the beginning.
Okay. Yeah. And didn't the original, one of the original founders is even saying that the dangers of Facebook now?
Yes, he is. I've seen his videos and some of his lectures. Basically, Facebook was the inventor of the social validation loop. So they were very clever. What they did was they found that, in fact, people get validation from posting and having comments and likes received on what they post. So really, the idea behind Facebook, although initially it was supposed to be social, it's really a business platform. And the design is, and the way that business works is to keep your eyes on the screen. And the way to keep your eyes on the screen is not through the stuff you're selling or offering or marketing, but through these social validation loops, which is, if I post something and somebody comments on it, it's going to be more likely that you're going to go on it and check it again. But they're really clever. What they do is they dole out the likes and the comments on a variable reinforcement schedule, which is very resistant to extinction, which is another way of saying addictive. So the likes don't come in on a one-to-one basis. So if you post something, a picture of yourself that everybody likes or a comment that everybody likes, you won't get all those likes all at once, even if they're all registered within a short period of time. What they do is they dole them out in a variable, unpredictable format, which keeps you going on and checking over and over again. And then you're more likely to then post again because you're elevating dopamine every time you get one of these little hits or one of these little likes or comments. So Facebook was and is designed to be addictive. I think, again, they are also under pressure now because everybody kind of knows this, and they're going to be held to a higher standard. I think that the days of the technology companies kind of producing technology that's inherently addictive without any consequence are over. The latest, of course, is the video game industry, which is stands to benefit tremendously from higher access speeds because a lot of games are now played on these portable untethered devices. And the WHO two Saturdays ago just did its final vote on classifying video game addiction as an official psychiatric disorder. And needless to say, the video game industry is responding very aggressively, and their lobbying organization is not happy about it because they don't want limits to be put on people's use, and they feel like if people think it's addictive, that may impact their unfettered use.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, go into that a little bit more here. So with 5G, one of the other ways it's being sold is like VR applications. So we know that the science is very much putting, you know, bright red flags on having a wireless and millimeter wave device that close to your eyes. But from a tech addiction standpoint, how concerned are you about sort of augmented reality, VR, and overlaying, you know, the digital experience versus the real world on top of the real world experience?
Well, I'm not a big fan in, you know, in hand. Or virtual experiences being the primary way that we experience our world. I do think there are applications for it. I would be lying to you if I said that there aren't any positive applications for VR technology. On the same token, it's a little concerning to me that we're going to be pushing that technology out without really knowing all the dangers. My biggest danger is that it's going to be overly addictive and overly compelling, and that people are just going to use it too much and create that imbalance that I see a lot. In terms of having it so close to your face because of the RF energy, again, I don't know that science well enough to speak about it intelligently, but I know that there are people who do. I mean, you know, I'm a ham operator, you know, by license, so I know enough about RF technology and RF energy to know that radio frequency energy, you know, creates you know, changes in tissue, not the least of which is it's mutagenic, and it's also potentially it heats the tissue as well. So I know enough that, you know, you don't touch an antenna of something transmitting with your fingers because you can burn yourself, and also you can create mutagenic effects. But again, I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for that. We can't be an expert in everything. Can I send you a link? Can I send you a link after the call that will?
Although I'm afraid to read it.
I appreciate your honesty. One more question about video games before we get into solutions for ourselves and our kids. You know, there's kind of a debate, I guess. The video game industry, for example, doesn't want people to have the belief that kids, teenagers, you know, grown men and women playing first-person shooter games it produces a negative effect in real life or more aggressive tendencies. What's your perspective on this sort of craze and rapid increase in first-person shooter video games?
That's very concerning to me. You know, obviously we treat a lot of people who have issues with first-person shooter games. You know, you got to understand the history of first-person shooter. They were developed by the U.S. Army. So, you know, originally the purpose of first-person shooter games were to help soldiers or potential soldiers desensitize to the act of carrying a gun and shooting people. And they were extremely effective. They do really work well. And they were actually put on the Army's website as sort of a recruitment tool. And they found that kids were using them so excessively, people, the game developers, started to produce them as standalone games. Because of the pleasure that people were experiencing from shooting. So there is a significant amount of data on the desensitization to violence that the game causes. And that data is well published. It doesn't necessarily cause violence, but it does desensitize one to the experience and the viewing of violence. And ultimately, that desensitization in a culture is not necessarily what we want. Now, that's in addition to the fact that they're very, very addictive, and they seem to lower some empathy scores with regard to violence. I mean, if you kill people and watch their brains splatter, you know, 500 times a week, that's going to affect the way you see human beings, even though it is a graphical depiction. I will say, in defense of the games, there isn't any definitive data that says it causes violence.
Okay. What are some dangers of an extrapolated trend of decrease of empathy throughout society?
Well, I think we're seeing that extrapolated trend of decreased empathy in society because every other day there's a mass shooting. So you have to have pretty decreased empathy to pick up a real gun and shoot a bunch of innocent people. That's not normal behavior, and there's no question that the incidence of those events has increased significantly, especially in the United States. So there's something going on in our culture, and I don't claim to have all the answers to this by any means, where people are feeling significantly more disenfranchised, disconnected. Another way to say is not empathetically connected, and certainly not feeling like their needs as a human being are attended to for whatever reason. You combine all those factors together with the ease of access and availability of weapons, and you've got a perfect storm for disaster, which is what we're seeing. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's pretty rare that you can go a week without a mass shooting at this point. And that's not normal.
Exactly. Thank you.
That's not normal. And it's not normal for any society. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the data for overall violence and safety in the world, or at least in the U.S., but actually this extends beyond the U.S., we are not more unsafe today than we were 100 years ago. So the idea that if you go back to the good old days that, you know, that's better, that's not true. Mm-hmm. So I'm not preaching anything to do with being a Luddite. Technology is not the evil here. It's the way we use technology and then overall our social climate beyond the technology. Technology is only one part of it. But so we are not more unsafe, but interestingly, there are a number of factors that leave people feeling more unsafe and more disconnected and more disenfranchised and with less to lose. You got to feel like there's nothing to lose.